Welcome to the Bible class. Yep. So, for tonight, we're going to be talking about We Would See Jesus through our brother Sam. So that sounds like it'll be a pretty good night around this subject. So we're going to open. Our reading is taken from John chapter 12, from verse 20 to the end. Okay, we're over to Sam now. We Would See Jesus. Thanks, Sam.
Thanks, Ted, and good evening, everyone. So of all the gospel writers, John seems to be the most manipulative, if you like, in his narration. And by that I mean he's got a specific message that he wants to get across from each incident that he described, and he doesn't describe too many incidents. And to do that, he deliberately leaves out any information that might distract from his message and retains just the very salient facts that help highlight whatever he's trying to get across. And all the gospel writers do that to a certain extent, but John is the real master of it. And, you know, when you read through John, you'll notice that not much actually happens in the book of John, or at least you'll notice John spends very little time describing events and actions, but a long time describing conversations that come out of those events. So if it was a movie, we'd say it was, you know, dialogue heavy or dialogue driven. You know, John's the sort of the Oppenheimer of movies rather than Mark, who's the Fast and Furious of movies. So John 12 is really an example of that. You know, the only action that really happens in that section that we read tonight is that some Gentiles come up and ask to see Jesus. Now that action's important, but it's really just a vehicle for all the dialogue that follows. So the action occurs in, you know, three verses, in verse 20 through to verse 22, and then the next 27 verses are people speaking, mostly Christ, but other people as well. So John uses this section to wrap up, if you like, tie off some loose ends, expound on some key ideas, themes that he's introduced earlier in his gospel. And we're going to see specifically how he does this a bit later. But John, as you probably know, uses these key words, key phrases throughout his gospel, and lots of them are introduced in the first few chapters and built on later on in his gospel, and they're built on in John chapter 12 as well, as we'll see shortly. So this is a real, John chapter 12, or this second half of John chapter 12, is a real turning point in Jesus' ministry. Partly because he's about to be, you know, less than 6 days later, so have a look at chapter 12, verse 1. Then Jesus, 6 days before the Passover. So he's going to get crucified at the Passover. So this is, you know, days away from his own death. But this last section of John chapter 12 is Jesus' final words to the Jewish people. His final appeal to them as a nation, to Jerusalem as a city, to respond to the Messiah that God sent to them. And this is, of course, despite the fact that we're only just, you know, a little bit past halfway, the halfway point in John's gospel. We're only sort of 11 and a half chapters into, 11 and a half chapters into a 21 chapter book. So, but this is where his ministry to the Jews stops. So in verse 35, Jesus says to the Jews, yet a little while is the light with you. And by a little while, he means a few more days. He's only going to be in their presence a little bit longer. And then in verse 36, notice what he does there. These things spake Jesus and departed, and he hide himself from them. He departs, he hides himself, that's it. That's the end of Jesus' ministry to the Jewish nation. And he symbolically sort of withdraws from them. They can't listen to him anymore, even if they wanted to. Now, Jesus does have a lot more to say. There's, you know, another 10 chapters of John. But he says it in private to his closest disciples. So the next time the Jewish people as a sort of nation see him en masse, he is in the middle of his trial by Pilate. And what does he say to the people then? Well, we can read it in John chapter 19, verse 5. Then came Jesus forth, wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. And Pilate said unto them, behold the man. So he's right standing there right in front of all the people. When the chief priests, therefore, and the officers saw him, they cried out, saying, crucify him, Pilate saith unto them, take ye him and crucify him, for I have found no fault in him. So Jesus says nothing to the crowd, does he? So if there was ever a chance of him making one last, moving, passionate speech to the Jewish nation, verse 5 of John chapter 19 it is. Thousands of people gathered in front of him. Why not, preach the gospel at that point? But their opportunity to see him and believe him as a nation had passed. And then a few verses later in John chapter 19, verse 13 and 15, when Pilate therefore heard that, he brought Jesus forth again and sat down in the judgment seat, and it was the preparation of the Passover, and he said to the Jews, behold your king. But they cried out, away with him, away with him, crucify him. Pilate said to them, shall I crucify your king? The chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. So again, Jesus says absolutely nothing to the Jewish people. They've had their opportunity, and that opportunity ends in John chapter 12. And what is it that sparks this turning point, this sort of final full stop on Jesus' ministry to the Jews? It's this request of a group of Gentiles to see him. So come back to verse 20 and 21 of John chapter 12. And it says there were certain Greeks among them that came up to worship at the feast. The same therefore came to Philip, which was of Bethsaida of Galilee, and desired him, saying, sir, we would see Jesus. It's a big cup. So I think it's this request from a small group of Gentiles that signals to Jesus that his work with the Jewish nation was over. He'd spent, 3.5 mostly fruitless years with them. They refused to listen. And this request from people outside the nation was a signal that the Jews' time of opportunity was over. It's time for the gospel to go to the Gentiles. Though, of course, it wasn't Jesus personally who took it there. So what's going on in John chapter 12 from verse 20 onwards? So it marks the end of Jesus' mission to the Jewish nation. What's the signal of that happening? The signal is that Greeks, Gentiles, asked to see him. Now you'll notice in verse 31 that Jesus prophesies the end of the Jewish religion or system of things. Verse 31 of John chapter 12, now is the judgment of this world. Now shall the prince of this world be cast out. So what's he talking about? Who's the prince of this world? Well, the prince of this world is often used to describe thinking, philosophy, that's opposed to God. And you can see that in Ephesians 6 verse 12 as an example of that. But notice that this is the judgment against this world, the prince of this world. And I think he's talking about the Jewish nation particularly, that system of things, political and religious, and particularly religious. For all their supposed status as God's people, how much they fail to reflect God's character and his teaching, well, that was all about to come to a head when they killed the Son of God. And the sentence on them would be carried out, 40 years later by the Romans under Titus. Then in verse 35, Jesus sort of says that he's not going to remain with them much longer. The light, Jesus, is not going to remain with them much longer. So contrast what Jesus tells the Jews here in John 12, verse 35, with what he says later to his close group of disciples in John chapter 13 to 17. So it's quite a contrast in message. In John chapter 12, he says to the Jews, yet a little while is the light with you. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness come upon you. So I'm only going to be with you for a little bit longer. Soon you'll be completely without light. Then again, in the next verse, in verse 36 of John 12, walk while you have the light. You've got the light now, use it. Believe in the light, that you may be children of light. These things Jesus spake and departed and did hide himself from them. So they could not see him any longer. So the message there is pretty clear to the Jews. But Jesus says quite different things to his disciples. To his disciples, on the other hand, he wants to show that, apart from the 3 days when he's going to be in the grave, he's never going to leave them. So a couple of examples, John chapter 14, verse 13. So he's talking to just the 11 disciples now. those that were in the upper room with him after Judas had left. Verse 3, where I am, there ye may be also. We're going to be together, says Jesus. I'm not going away from you, apart from, as I said, those 3 days in the grave. John 14, verse 18, I will not leave you comfortless. I will come to you. I'm coming back to be with you, says Christ, again, after those 3 days in the grave. Verse 21, he that hath my commandments, I will love him and will manifest. I'll show myself to him. And so that's a direct contrast, isn't it, to him hiding and departing from the Jews in John chapter 12. And John 16, verse 16, a little while and ye shall not see me, and again a little while and ye shall see me, because I go to the Father. You're going to be able to see me, says Jesus. Again, we can still see Jesus. Again, a big contrast, isn't it, to him hiding himself from the Jews where they couldn't see him anymore. So, two quite different messages to two quite different groups of people. To the Jewish nation, Jesus says, my mission is ending here and now. You'll no longer have access to me. But to his disciples, on the other hand, he's promised, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So this is the end of his mission to the Jewish nation, but certainly not his end of his mission to his true believers, his disciples. What else is going on in John chapter 12? Verse 36, as we've seen, you know, a little bit of action happens. Jesus physically hides himself from them. Again, you know, symbolic of his spiritual withdrawal from the nation as a whole. And then in verse 37 to 43, we've got John's sort of summary statement of the Jewish response to Jesus, or lack thereof, really. So in those verses, we've got, you know, a really disheartening summary issue inserted by John himself into the record of the gospel. So, you know, one of John's big themes right up until this point in his gospel is that the Jews, despite being given every opportunity by Jesus, refuse to listen to him. And they continue, the Jews continue to cling to this notion that, you know, they are the chosen, you know, the saved because of who they are. You know, they're the descendants of Abraham, the holders of the law, the inhabitants of the promised land. In their heads, they don't need saving at all, do they? They are saved. They're, you know, genetically righteous somehow. None of those things would save them, as we know. And God had sent his son in this sort of last-ditch effort to get them to turn back to him. But, as we know, they didn't turn, at least as a nation. You know, we've certainly got individuals, the disciples amongst them, Nicodemus, Mary, those faithful women. But as a nation, they refused the Son of God. And soon, you know, 40 years later, as a nation, they will be destroyed and their temple flattened. They'd be physically removed from that promised land, and God's message was going to move on to a different phase. It was going to go off to the Gentiles. So this is the end of an era, the end of 1,500 years of the law of Moses, of, you know, the Jewish nationhood. It's happening right here in John chapter 12, a hugely significant event, historically speaking. And then, of course, we have the emphasis finally on the gospel going to all men, so not going to be restricted just to the Jews any longer, but to all men, all the Gentiles. John chapter 12 and verse 26, if any man serve me, not just, you know, the Pharisees, not just, you know, the high priests, not just the Levites, if any man serve me, let him follow me, and where I am, there shall also my servant be. If any man serve me, him will my Father honour. Verse 32, and I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men unto me, not just the Jews, all men. Verse 46, I am come a light into the world, that whosoever believeth on me should not abide in darkness. Not just this world, not just the Jewish world, but the world in general. Verse 47, if any man hear my words and believe not, I judge him not, for I come not to judge the world, but to save the world. So again, the world, the whole world, not just this world, the Jewish world. So no longer is the gospel going to be, you know, an exclusive Jewish hope. The gospel is about to be shared globally through Jesus' apostles. And Jesus' death and resurrection is going to save all men. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that later. So come back to verse 21 of chapter 12. And I just want to look at why it's Philip that these Gentiles approach with their request to see Jesus. And I think this is one of the examples that we talked about of John expanding on some ideas that he introduced, you know, earlier in his record. So come back to John chapter 1, and we're just going to read a chunk, or Zoe might read it for us, we'll see in a minute, of John chapter 1. And in John chapter 1, you know, Jesus has already been introduced by John the Baptist, back in verse 36 to 38. So John the Baptist introduces Jesus to Andrew and Peter in verse 36 to 38, and probably the Apostle John as well, though he doesn't specifically name himself in his own gospel. And then in verse 37, you'll see that they follow Jesus. And then in verse 38, you'll see that they seek Jesus. And then in verse 39, they see Jesus. And then in verse 42, they are brought to Jesus. So these men, Andrew, Peter, and John, follow this process. They follow Jesus, they seek Jesus, they see Jesus, they are brought to Jesus. But Philip is different. So Philip's the first disciple in John's record that Jesus deliberately goes out and finds. Have a look at verse 43, which Zoe will read for us.
The following day, Jesus wanted to go to Galilee, and he found Philip and said to him, "Follow me."
Okay, so he finds Philip, specifically goes out and finds Philip. And what does he say to him, Zoe?
"Follow me."
Excellent. "Follow me." So the other three disciples, soon to be apostles, find Jesus, but Jesus finds Philip. The other three follow Jesus without invitation. Philip is the first that Jesus instructs to follow him. So we'll notice, Zoe's going to read a huge chunk for us now because she's got the best reading voice. Verse 43 to 51, Zoe, is that right?
Yeah, sure.
So just notice as Zoe's reading this, you might notice some of the parallels, the echoes, the language that's used in relation to Philip in John chapter 1 and in John chapter 12. Take it away, Zoe.
Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." And Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Philip said to him, "Come and see." Jesus saw Nathanael coming towards him and said to him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no deceit." Nathanael said to him, "How do you know me?" Jesus answered and said to him, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Nathanael answered and said to him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God, you are the King of Israel." Jesus answered and said to him, "Because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Most assuredly, I say to you, hereafter you shall see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man."
Okay, so on the screen we've got a few sort of parallel ideas, phrases that link it back to John. We'll link John chapter 12 back to John chapter 1. We've got the idea of "follow me" in both chapters. Bethsaida gets mentioned. Andrew gets mentioned. Philip says to Nathanael, "Come and see the Messiah," and that's exactly what the words the Gentiles echo in or the Greeks echo in verse 21 of John 12. We would see Jesus. Verse 49, "Thou art the Son of God and the Son of Man," and you'll see, you know, angels ascending and descending. So the Son of Man will be glorified in John 12. Heaven's opened, a voice comes out of heaven. And then this emphasis on belief, which is in John 1 verse 50, right through John chapter 12 from verse 36 to 47. And the emphasis on seeing in verse 46 of John chapter 1, which is in verse 38 to 45 of John chapter 12. So some pretty clear parallels that John is sort of wrapping up this story that he started in John chapter 1. He's sort of reflecting back on it in John chapter 12. So what's John trying to tell us through sort of linking this language of John chapter 1 and John chapter 12? Well, John chapter 1 is the very start of Jesus' ministry, isn't it? The start of his ministry to the Jews. And you'll notice, maybe as Zoe read it, the emphasis on Israel in John chapter 1. In verse 31, he, that is Christ, should be manifest to Israel. Verse 47, Nathanael is an Israelite indeed in whom there is no guile. Verse 48, Nathanael is under a fig tree, which we know is a symbol of Israel. And verse 49, Nathanael calls Jesus the King of Israel. And then, of course, as we know, in John chapter 18, the Jews reject him as king in favour of Caesar. So this is the start of the ministry to Israel. And John chapter 12 is the end of that ministry to Israel. John chapter 1 is a call to see Jesus to the Jews, and in seeing him, you know, believe on him. But by John chapter 12, who are the people that are seeing Jesus and believing in him at the end of his ministry? It's not the, you know, the vast majority of the Jews. It's this small group of Gentiles. So this is the message, I think, of the second half of John chapter 12. After 3.5 years of, you know, teaching and preaching and miracle working amongst the Jews, what was their response to him? Nothing, or next to nothing, apart from a few men and women. Just a few, you know, a handful of men and women could actually see Jesus and believe on him. And some of these were not, you know, even the Jews to whom Jesus was sent to minister. As John points out in John chapter 1 and verse 11, he came to his own, he came to the Jewish people, and his own received him not. So those first 12 chapters of John are all about the Jews receiving not the Messiah that the Father sent to them. And John chapter 12 is the, you know, the Jews' time of opportunity is about to end. In a few days' time, they're going to reject their king. You know, he's not going to be the king of Israel to them. They're going to, you know, say, you know, we've got Caesar to our king. They're going to elect to crucify their actual king. And as a nation, their time of opportunity would be sealed. And then, you know, within a few chapters of Acts, the gospel starts to spread to the Gentiles, where it is relatively.
And Philip's actually named after the Tetrarch for that area. And it's a very mixed Jewish and Gentile area, similar to Decapolis. And so maybe these Greeks knew where he was from, yeah, and thought he might be more amenable. He would understand us better than most of the others. And so, because he was from that area,
yeah,
he was the one that they asked to see Jesus.
Yeah, he would have been used to mixing with Gentiles, and they would have been happier to approach him. He's the only disciple with a Greek name too, I think. Yeah. Okay, so moving on from Bethsaida, which we're not going to talk about, this idea of death becomes a bit of a theme in this section of John chapter 12 as well. Darcy, have you got verse 24 there? John 12. Please. Tar.
Most assuredly I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it remains alone. And if it dies, it produces much grain.
Okay, so we've got several layers of this idea of death here. Jesus isn't, you know, talking, or not just talking about literal death here. So as he goes on to show in verse 25 and 26, he is really talking about the death of self, isn't he? The death of pride and the resurrection in its place of a servant to others. So he's talking about transformation, something that we all need to go through, a transformation that can only come about through death to self and resurrection to newness of life, as Paul puts it in Romans 6. So the process of life is through death. But, you know, and the fruit that's brought forth in that process is the fruit of the Spirit that we can read about in, you know, Galatians chapter 5. But there's also, of course, the impending death of the Jewish political nation, which Romans 11 tells us was necessary for the gospel to go to the Gentiles and bring forth much fruit from that as well. But of course, Christ was also literally about to die as well, and he would become the first fruits, which I think Daniel reminded us of on Sunday, the first fruits of them that slept, first fruits of a huge harvest of resurrected ones, including us. So one seed again producing much fruit. So there's lots of different ways we can look at this process, this transformative process through death into life. The death of the seed producing much fruit. And this theme of death continues in verse 32 and 33, which Darcy will now also read for us. If he would, if he doesn't mind.
And I, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all peoples to myself. And he said, signifying by what death he would die.
Okay, so this time Jesus is really talking literally, isn't he, about his literal death. And even his audience understands that Jesus is talking about, you know, literal death by crucifixion, because that's revealed in the question they ask in verse 34. They can't quite comprehend a Messiah that has to die. That doesn't fit in with their concept of Messiah at all. So they're asking, you know, we know from the scriptures that Messiah is going to last forever. What's this all about, the Son of Man dying? So they understand that Jesus is talking about his death. Now, this is, of course, this is a double reference, isn't it? First, really, it's a reference back to, again, an earlier section of John chapter 3, and Jesus' conversation with Nicodemus. But that, in turn, is also a reference back to Moses and the brass serpent in Numbers chapter 21. So we're not going to turn up John chapter 3, but again, we've got this bunch of connections between the two chapters. We've got references to the ruler of the Jews. We've got references to miracles that Jesus has done, and yet still they don't believe in him. We've got this idea of the Son of Man being lifted up. And we've got the idea of whosoever again. So that was a really important theme in John chapter 3, the idea that God is saving not just the Jewish people, not just the exclusive, you know, Pharisee class that Nicodemus was part of, but in verse 15 of John chapter 3, whosoever believeth in him, in Christ, should not perish, but have eternal life. For God so loved the world, not just the Jewish world, that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. For God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. So again, these ideas of a universal salvation rather than salvation limited just to the Jews. So Jesus is using this, but you'll notice that his reference about being lifted up comes from John chapter 3, and that's what tells us that he's really talking about Moses lifting up the serpent in the wilderness. So verse 14 of John chapter 3, and as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. So I think that's what he's talking about in John 12 verse 32 when he says, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men unto me. So he's making a reference back to John chapter 3, and we need to understand that he's talking about in the same way that the serpent was lifted up in the wilderness. It's lifted up like Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, which again is a reference back to John chapter 21. So he's clearly talking about this incident in the wilderness, which was the brass serpent on the pole. And it's one that we know pretty well, isn't it? And there's a clear parallel between Jesus being lifted up in crucifixion and the serpent lifted up on the pole. You know, even just visually, you can sort of see that there's a parallel there. So we're going to come back to Numbers chapter 21 and just have a think about this section as well and what Jesus is trying to get us to learn from it in both John chapter 3, but particularly in John chapter 12. So, Numbers 21. Joel, can you do some reading for me?
Yep.
Excellent. Okay, do you want to do verse 4 to 9, please, of Numbers 21?
Then they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the soul of the people became very discouraged and annoyed. The people spoke against God and against Moses. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? There is no food and no water, and our soul loathes this worthless bread.
Okay, so, yep, cheers. So, yep, you can pick it up in a minute. So you can see the sort of the illogic of their statement here. There is no bread, neither is there any water, and our soul loathes this light bread. So this bread that you're giving to us every day, this miracle that you're performing for us every day, you know, there's no bread around here, and we don't like the bread you're giving us. You know, it's complete illogic here. So the people had come to loathe this light bread, as they call it, which God sent to save them and sustain them in the wilderness. They loathed God's salvation freely given to them. You know, just as they loathed the word of God and later on in John chapter 12, God's own son. And of course, the irony of them claiming that God had brought them into the wilderness to die when that, you know, very bread was the one thing that stood between them and death. So the Jews here saw a miracle of the manna appearing every day, a miracle every day. But they still don't believe in God's saving power. So you can sort of see the, you know, incredible irony of that. And it's exactly what John says about his own generation. He says, though he had done so many miracles before them, yet they believed not on him, in John chapter 12 and verse 37. And here, Israel in the wilderness is exactly the same. A miracle every day, bread appearing from nowhere. Don't believe that God can save us. Joel, verse 6.
So the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and many of the people of Israel died.
Okay, so what do fiery serpents represent here in our, you know, symbology of what's happening in the wilderness here? Sin, yes. How do we know that snakes represent sin?
Because Adam and Eve.
Adam and Eve, excellent. Okay, so, you know, Genesis chapter 3, snakes associated with sin, they're the ones that introduce sin-type thinking into the world, aren't they? And what do these snakes produce?
Poison,
yep, fire, poison, probably poison, venom, yep. Death, excellent. Okay, so, and what's the product, what's the producer of death in our life? And a supporting quote? Romans 6, verse 23, wages of sin is death. Okay, so we've got these little snakes hanging around, biting, producing death. It represents sin in our lives, doesn't it? Verse 7.
Before the people came to Moses, he said, "We have sinned, we have spoken against the Lord and against you. Pray to the Lord that you take away the serpents from us." So Moses prayed for the people. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Make a fiery serpent, set it on a pole, and it shall be that everyone who is bitten, then he looks at it, shall be."
Cool. So you'll notice that Moses doesn't say, well, you know, let's check the law of Moses. I'm sure there's an offering in there. You know, maybe 12 oxen should do it. Moses knows that there's no solution in the law to this issue, as there wasn't for many, many issues. The law was not the solution to the bite of sin. In fact, you know, 1 Corinthians 15, the strength of sin is in the law. So it made sin worse, in fact. So Moses knows he has to go outside the law to find a solution to the bite of sin and the death that results from it. And you'll notice as well that God doesn't actually do what the people ask. So verse 7 says, ask God to take away the serpents from us. God doesn't do that, does he? He doesn't take away the serpents, but he does give a solution to the serpent's bite. Now, in exactly the same way that God hasn't removed sin or our inclination towards it, but he still gives us a solution to it. And what's the solution here? It's a whomping great big serpent on a pole, isn't it? Made of brass. And, you know, we can see the imagery up on the screen, the parallel with Jesus on the cross. But think about it a little bit further. You know, Jesus is represented by a snake here, a snake that we have already seen is normally, you know, representative of sin, a snake made of brass, brass that also normally represents sin and flesh per, you know, Goliath. Now, sometimes Jesus is represented by curious things in Scripture to give us, you know, a whole picture. And this is definitely one of those curious things. You wouldn't expect the Son of God to be represented by a snake made of brass, but he is. So why is Jesus on the cross represented by a brass snake on a pole? Because Jesus on the cross represents the death of flesh, doesn't it? Of self, of human pride and lust. Exactly the lesson of John chapter 12 and the seed that dies in the ground. Except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abides alone, but if it die, it brings forth much fruit. He that loveth his life shall lose it, and he that hateth, crucifies his life in this world, shall keep it unto life eternal. So the path to life is through death, and specifically death to self and selfishness. And that's what Jesus was demonstrating in his crucifixion, wasn't it? The crucifixion of his own flesh, the flesh that he shares with us, with all its tendencies toward pride and towards lust. But notice in verse 8 that the looking on the serpent on the pole is the key. Just look at that serpent on the pole. That's what's going to save you, says Moses to the people. Now that doesn't sound like an act of faith, but really it is, isn't it? Because why would you bother looking at the serpent on the pole if you didn't believe that it could do something for you? You had to believe to be bothered to look at it in the first place. And what are those Greeks come asking Philip? We would see Jesus. Their aim was to look at the serpent on the pole and so be saved. So what's Israel being told here? You know, what would you be doing if there were, you know, little poisonous snakes all over the ground? You'd be looking down, wouldn't you? You'd be looking carefully at the ground to avoid the fiery serpents. But what's the cure? The cure is to look up. Look up at the big snake on the pole. Don't look down, look up. The cure for sin is not to focus on the sin, but to focus on the one who crucified the flesh. Keep your focus on Jesus is the lesson of the brass snake on the pole. One more verse, Joel, verse 9, please.
So Moses made a bronze serpent, put it on a pole. And so it was, if the serpent had bitten anyone, they looked at the bronze serpent lived.
Okay, so notice in verse 8, everyone who looks on the serpent will live. Verse 9, any man who looks on the serpent of brass, he lived. It's that same all-encompassing language, isn't it? Not just the Jews. And John really references this in John chapter 12. And I've sort of tried to highlight the sort of parallel ideas that John is pulling out of Numbers 21 and into John chapter 12. The Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent, a serpent of brass in verse 8 and verse 9. And that represents Jesus in John chapter 12 and verse 21. Verse 32, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men unto me. Everyone that is bitten in verse 8 of Numbers 21 and looks on it shall live. Verse 9, any man when he beheld the serpent of brass lived. Certain Greeks, any man, the Gentiles, come to Jesus and say, or come to Philip and say, we would see Jesus. If I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men unto me. Any man, all men. Verse 47 sort of brings it all together. If any man hear my word and believe not, I judge him not, for I come not to judge the world, but to save the world. Any man, the world. An all-encompassing method of salvation that Christ is offering here. And that's the lesson I think that John is picking up out of Numbers 21 and the words that the same principles there. The key is to behold, to look, see the serpent on the pole. And that's exactly what the Gentiles want to do in verse 21 of John 12. And yet Jewish audience of your Jesus' Jewish audience, they couldn't perceive the need. And Christ says, I will draw all men unto me, just as those bitten in the wilderness had to come to the serpent on the pole to look at it in faith to be healed from the serpent's bite. So that's the serpent on the pole. So the Jews physically saw Jesus, didn't they? But they didn't see him with the eyes of faith. And they didn't really see because they didn't believe. Despite all the miracles that Jesus had done in front of them, despite all the miracles that happened in the wilderness, that the Jews didn't believe then either. But the Gentiles, in coming back to John chapter 12 and verse 21, they want to see Jesus because they believe in him. And you'll notice how John sort of conflates these ideas of light, of seeing, with the idea of believing and of faith in John chapter 12. And we're not going to go through this whole section in detail, but he talks about, you know, the light being with you. And of course you need light to be able to see, don't you? Without light you can't see. And then he sort of merges that into the idea of belief as well. So the idea of, you know, seeing in light and believing are all connected here right through this section of John chapter 12 from verse 35 through to verse 47. And when John is talking about seeing, he's not just talking about looking at. He's talking about looking at Jesus, perceiving what he's about, and having faith in him as the Son of God and the embodiment of God's method of salvation. And when, you know, Jesus quotes from Isaiah, it becomes what, you know, apparent what type of seeing he's talking about. You know, he's blinded their eyes and hardened their heart. So, you know, Isaiah gives us the key there, that they should not see with their eyes. Is he talking about physical seeing? Not really. He's talking about understanding with their heart and being converted, and I should heal them. So Jesus was, of course, the true light, as John tells us right back at the beginning of his gospel, John chapter 1 and verse 9. This was the true light that came into the world. But his aim wasn't just to be the only light in the world. He wants us to develop light in ourselves too, and that's sort of our year's theme, hasn't it been, for the Bible classes. John chapter 11 and verse 10, but if a man walk in the night, he stumbleth because there is no light in him. That's the key, isn't it? We have to have light in ourselves as well, in us, not just relying on others for light, but developing light in ourselves. And this idea is not just in John either. Philippians 2 verse 15, he may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom ye shine as lights in the world. So once this light of Christ had been taken away physically, there were still lights left, weren't there? And they were Jesus' true disciples. Ephesians 5, you were sometimes darkness, but now are ye light. You are lights. You're not just walking in light. You are lights, says Paul in Ephesians chapter 5. So the point of light is to have light in ourselves. With the true light gone, we're going to be without light unless we are also producing that same light. And we can only do that if we have faith. That, of course, was the great failing of Israel, wasn't it? They failed to develop light in themselves. And as soon as they had a good leader, they did the right thing. But as soon as they had a bad leader, they did the wrong thing. The Jews saw Jesus, but they didn't perceive him. They didn't have faith in him. They didn't perceive him as the Son of God. They didn't perceive him as the door to salvation. They didn't perceive him as the way, the truth, and the life. And because of this, as soon as the light went, they were left in darkness again. How do we know if we have light within us? Well, John, in his letters, a bit later on, has a pretty simple test for us. John chapter 1 and verse 7, but if we walk in the light, as he is in the light, we have fellowship one with another. So fellowship is an indicator that we have life, and the blood of Christ Jesus, his Son, cleanseth us from all sin. By way of contrast, First John chapter 2 and verse 9, he that saith he is in the light and hates his brother is in darkness until now. In the next verse, he that loveth his brother abideth in the light. So darkness, hate, love is light. And there is no occasion of stumbling in him. And then verse 11, he that hateth his brother is in darkness again and walketh in darkness and knoweth not where he goeth, because that darkness hath blinded his eyes. Are we in darkness or are we in light? This is how you know, says John. Do we love or do we hate?